Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 1,000 pages, 1 million documents. The Republican-led Senate Intelligence Report contains detailed accounts about the 2016 Trump campaign's contacts with Russian government officials and intelligence officers. The report concludes with certainty that threads that linked those relationships to Russia's attempts to sabotage the U.S. election in 2016. The report also concludes with certainty that the Russians are at it again in this election. So this hour on Point, we're going to take a look at Vladimir Putin's power plays, both inside Russia and inside the 2020 American election. And we'll start today with Mark Mazzetti. He is a New York Times investigative reporter. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2018 for his reporting on President Trump and Russia. And he joins us from Washington. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's really great to have you, Mark, and specifically because we really wanted to spend quite a bit of time looking at Russia today, because A, it's back in the news due to the suspected poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny, and we'll talk about that more in a minute. And also because, you know, this Senate Intelligence Report came out last week, and in any other time in American history, it probably would be the biggest news, I think. And yet it came, there was reporting around it, and due to all the other chaos in life right now, I just don't think it got the attention it deserved. So I just want to explain to listeners why we're doing this. And start with this question to you, Mark. We're in 2020 here, the 2020 election. I mean, what did you draw from the Senate Intelligence Committee's report that helps us understand what the Russians might be doing to have an impact on this election this year?
Well, I agree with you that the report didn't get the attention it probably deserves, and you know, it should be continued to be examined going forward. I will admit also that I didn't necessarily have very high expectations for this report. You know, we had heard that they were going to be working on this final volume, this Senate Intelligence Committee. And, you know, a lot of people have moved on already, right? After the Mueller investigation concluded, people had their opinions about it. And I didn't expect necessarily to learn a whole lot new in this. But I was wrong. And I think what was extraordinary about the report, not only was that it was signed off on by both Republicans and Democrats, but it was focused on this idea of Russian intelligence interference, election interference as a national security threat. So look at all the different ways that the Russian government tried to make inroads with the Trump campaign in 2016, tried to influence the election. And there was a lot of detail about those connections, about those interactions. And while we don't know a great deal about what they might be doing right now, the American intelligence community hasn't said very much about what the Russians are doing, other than to say they are continuing to try to influence American electoral politics. It's just a good reminder of what happened in 2016. And let me just also say that, you know, we paid a lot of attention to the Mueller investigation and the Mueller report. And the difference between this report and the Mueller report is that it's a different type of document. The Mueller investigation was a legal inquiry determined to amass evidence, ultimately with the aim of making a decision of should they prosecute people or not. So as you remember, a lot of the language was very tortured. There were a lot of double negatives. It was kind of hard to follow. This is written with a greater level of certainty because there wasn't that burden that the intelligence community had. They didn't have to say there is enough evidence to lead to criminal charges. They were just saying the Russian campaign was sweeping and the members of the Trump campaign, in some cases, were winning partners, even if there was not a full-blown conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Mark, let's do it this way. I mean, you won the Pulitzer Prize for your reporting on Trump and Russia. So I just want to reiterate that very few people know more about this issue broadly than you do. So given that, What are some of the things, let's start with like one thing that surprised you most from this Senate Intelligence Committee report that surprised you most?
So I was reading through the report and in some ways had this flashback to 2017 when we were reporting on all these disparate individual episodes involving figures we now know of, Paul Manafort, Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, right? And it was hard to see things in a kind of cohesive whole because we were just, you know, we were in the dark feeling around for the elephant, right? Trying to figure out what it all meant. This report has much more specifics about the nature of the Russian operation to make contact with these individuals. So specifically, Paul Manafort, it goes into extreme detail about Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman of the Trump campaign. And what was known, of course, was he had been deeply tied to Ukrainian oligarchs who were pro-Russia. He was, in fact, in debt to them. He had worked for them over the years. What this report shows is how much those oligarchs were tied into Russian intelligence and how much Manafort, because he was compromised financially by these individuals, in a way was giving insight in effect to the Russian government about what the Trump campaign was up to. So this report creates much more direct ties between Manafort and members of Russian intelligence, named officers of Russian intelligence that the Senate report identifies. That's one. Another is
can I just jump in here, sure. about Manafort, because I've got the report here in front of me, and to your point earlier about the unvarnished language, the stark language that the report uses that we didn't quite see in the Mueller report. There's a section here where it says quite clearly, quote, taken as a whole, Manafort's high-level access and willingness to share information with individuals closely affiliated with the Russian intelligence services represented a grave counterintelligence threat. I mean, that when I read that I have to say, even after all this time and this many years and all this coverage, it did stop me in my tracks.
I agree with you. And the way this report was written, the sort of knowing and certainty with which this report was written, was a surprise to me. And as I said, it sort of is seen through the lens of national security threats, right? Counterintelligence is efforts by foreign intelligence services to influence the United States, to make contacts in the United States. And so that's what I think was particularly striking. And they don't, you're right, they don't, it is unvarnished language. And in Manafort and others, I'll take another example. You know, there's the now infamous episode at Trump Tower in 2016, where Donald Trump Jr. and Manafort and Jared Kushner meet a few Russians, including a Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya. And she, you know, it was always a little bit uncertain what her ties were. She's certainly known to have close ties to some individuals in the Kremlin. But again, this report says that that meeting was, you can draw a direct line between the individuals who met at Trump Tower offering, they'd come and offering dirt on Hillary Clinton, and Russian government and the Russian intelligence services. And so again, it takes this, you know, episode we've written about for some time and puts it more into the context of what the Russians might have been doing. Now, I should point out that it does not neatly draw together all these points and connect all these dots into, you know, this is Vladimir Putin's very well orchestrated campaign, directed by individual X and carried out in a coherent and thought out way. It's still, the report still is, I guess, frustrating, but that's reality, about, you know, how does this individual episode tie into that? How do these things tie together? It's clear the committee doesn't know. And Masha, I'm sure, can talk about this as well. You know, this may just be the nature of what was going on. It was not a centrally organized campaign by Putin, but it was maybe blessed and people set off to go make their own individual inroads into the Trump campaign. And let me just finally say that that the Intelligence Committee makes it clear that the Trump campaign was ripe for this kind of penetration, that you had all of these figures who were either friends of Donald Trump, businessmen and women with ties to Russia over the years, to Ukraine over the years, and very few had actual government experience. And so all of these people, for lack of a better term, were easy marks for the Russians.
So about Putin, though, I think the report does expressly state that they found that Putin personally directed the hack, the DNC hack, which then led to those documents being made public by WikiLeaks.
Yes, so they can say with certainty that Putin was overall blessed this campaign. He directed some of the most notorious incidents we know about, the hacking and the leaking of the emails. And as we know, that the intelligence community believes that, you know, Vladimir Putin, by 2016, was firmly on the side of getting Donald Trump elected. If he had not, in 2015, known exactly which way the Russian government was going to lean, by the time it was Donald Trump against Hillary Clinton, there's really no sort of debate, if you're in the Kremlin, about who you want.
So, Mark, then we've just got a minute to go before our first break here. There's other details in the report that I want to talk with you about, but this doesn't materially change our understanding of what happened in the 2016 elections. You're just saying that it provides sort of incontrovertible detail that further deepens our understanding of it.
So here's what we don't have, right? Even after all this, there is still never the firm conclusion you come away where the Trump campaign and the Russian government, in effect, sat down, got together, and said, "Let's help each other. Let us help you." And Donald Trump was firmly accepting of that. It's still a little bit impressionistic of exactly how these contacts played out, and therefore frustrating, and perhaps, you know, those conclusions will never be drawn from.
Well, we'll be right back with more. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about Vladimir Putin's power plays this hour, both in the 2016 presidential election here in the United States, in the 2020 election, and domestically within Russia as well. Mark Mazzetti joins us. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. And we've been discussing with Mark the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on contacts between the 2016 Trump campaign and the Russian government and Russian intelligence officers. Mark, there's some more details I'd actually love to dig into with you here for a second before we turn to Masha Gessen, who we will hear from in just a moment. For example, can you tell us about why the committee included findings on Donald Trump's pre-presidential trips to Russia and what they found?
It's a good question about why they included it. I mean, there was a kitchen sink quality to this report where there's a lot of different things that are explored and certainly not tied together. But they spend some time examining trips that Donald Trump took to Russia in the 90s. And had all of these contacts with, you know, Russian government officials and business people. He was he was scouting out beauty pageants, the prospect of doing a Miss Universe pageant in 2013. And he is he has some contacts with a former Miss Moscow, who the report goes into some detail about. And it isn't there are no firm conclusions in the report about, you know, what this might have led to. It certainly doesn't say that, you know, as a result of these trips, the Russians had compromising material on now President Trump. But it certainly raises that possibility. And there's some allegations about affair he was having while he was in Moscow. And so there's this implication, but it is not, there is no real firm understanding of what this all leads to in the report.
Okay. So now let's turn to Masha Gessen. Masha is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of many books, including Surviving Autocracy and The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Masha also grew up in what is now Russia as well. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So Masha, it's great to have you because there is a lot to discuss. And as I promised listeners, we will get to the poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. But I wanted to ask you to just reflect on a couple of things that you heard Mark Mazzetti say. First of all, let's just start with the portion of the Senate intelligence report that we just talked about. It's really about the Russian art of compromise and the possibility that there is compromising information about Donald Trump. I just wonder, you know, given your personal history in Russia, just help us understand, why is that important?
I actually don't think it's important.
Okay.
I think that, you know, I mean, of course, Russian intelligence services collect the maximum amount of embarrassing, potentially actionable in terms of blackmail information on any mark, as do really any intelligence services anywhere in the world. I think that the underlying assumption of looking at this is that it is possible to embarrass Donald Trump. It is possible to hold something over him and, you know, and blackmail him on to do, in this case, Vladimir Putin's bidding. And I don't think we've seen any evidence that that kind of mechanism actually works with Trump. So it's, you know, it's a curious bit of the report. We, you know, we have some more insinuations, but I don't see how it's informative.
Okay, so point taken. Then what aspects of what the Intelligence Committee reports, what their conclusions were, are important? And I ask you this, I don't feel defensive about this at all. I really want to help myself and listeners understand meaningfully what we should glean from these 1,000 pages to help us understand what happened in 2016.
Honestly, I don't know that it adds anything to our understanding of what happened in 2016. I think, you know, I read it with great interest because I'm, you know, like the details about Trump's travel to Moscow in 1996 and his travel in 2013. That's all quite curious, but I don't think it substantively adds to, you know, what we learned from the Mueller report.
Mm-hmm. Well, you heard Mark say a little bit earlier that this report, too, does not provide anyone with this sort of a neat connect the dots, right? A straight line, as it were, from Putin to the interference in the 2016 election, maybe save for that the section that says that Putin personally ordered the hack of the DNC. He also said that maybe this is how it works in Russia, that it's a web rather than a straight line. And your thoughts on that? How does it work in Russia when these intelligence operations take place?
I think there are different ways that it works, and I don't know that this is necessarily typical. There's certainly a lot of operations that are very firmly vertically controlled by the Kremlin. I think what we were dealing with here is, and this, you know, we learned about this from the Mueller report and a bit here, I think, although I think the Mueller report was much more colorful in this, right, was the sense of a very messy effort by a bunch of people who, in my reading, you know, were all trying to distinguish themselves and advance up the career ladder, or really had their own grift going, right? I mean, I read it as a description of a whole bunch of grifters, all of them with their own nebulous agenda, all of them trying to get something done. I mean, that's, for example, my reading of the famous Trump Tower meeting, right, with Natalia Veselnitskaya. I think that this report emphasizes Veselnitskaya's connections to the Russian government. They're not detailed from what my own reporting, from what I know about her connections to the Russian government. They're not significant. She was not working on behalf of the Russian government. What I think she was doing was trying to establish some sort of footing for both for her client and then possibly something that she could then trade with the prosecutor's office in Russia, or something that could curry more favor, right? If you imagine this rather as a web of con men, a web of grifters, a web of people, all of whom are selling something that they don't necessarily have, in order to get something that they can barter for more. That's how I would make sense of it.
Right. Mark, did you want to respond to what Masha was saying there?
I wouldn't disagree at all with the characterization. I think that's a good characterization, this idea of sort of grifters on both sides, all looking for their own angle. We certainly know that about Manafort. We know that about other associates of the Trump campaign, certainly. Again, thinking it through this context of a lot of them didn't think that they were going to win and Donald Trump was going to be president. And so what is happening during this period of time, you know, may have just been as much about contacts for the future, Paul Manafort getting whole with the oligarchs he was in the hawk to, and others who were looking beyond November 2016, when presumably Hillary Clinton wins and they can go off and do their business in the future. So I think we can't discount that as a way to look at this.
Okay.
I think that's incredibly important point, actually, that neither side thought that the Trump campaign was going to win. So the groundwork they were laying, you know, it was not for dealing with the Trump presidency.
But let's dig a little bit deeper into this, because, okay, so neither side thought they were going to win. But in the United States, there was still, I mean, the report and the Mueller report both lay out in no uncertain terms that these contacts were made, that people lied, that Michael Flynn lied, that Paul Manafort lied, that fundamentally there was no political or moral trouble. No one lost any sleep in accepting whatever the Russians said they had to offer. Now, I think that says something about the health and well-being of our political system, putting Russia aside here for a second. Except that, Masha, you have written, I think, over and over again, how you're seeing echoes of the system that you grew up in. There, you're hearing those echoes now in the United States. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I was just, you know, just looking in disbelief at the Republican Party's statement on no longer having a platform. Its entire platform is supporting Donald Trump for president of the United States, who, you know, in turn also has no policy and no platform. I mean, the rate. And blatant nature of the way, you know, we have slid toward personified, personalized autocratic rule has been absolutely mind-boggling. You know, in some ways, I don't know that Russia is the best parallel. It's the parallel I know best, and I've been writing about totalitarianism for and in particular Russia for most of my life. So that's the prism I use, and that's the knowledge I use. But it's that sense that it's all about one man, and the last few months also this incredible sense that nothing works. Right. Mm-hmm. This was probably one of the distinguishing characteristics of living in a post-Soviet country. And I wrote a column a few weeks ago on how the United States is like a post-Soviet country. You know, one of the things about it was that you could believe nothing, and you could expect nothing to work as it's intended to. Like if I had in the early 90s, if I had one day when things just went like they were supposed to, when institutions worked and, you know, trade worked and just, you know, everything worked like the road was there and the car didn't break down. It was a banner day. And I think in the way that the Trump administration has responded to the coronavirus pandemic, it has just brought back the sort of the trauma of living in a state where nothing works. And I think there are particular reasons why it's started to work like that, and why it's that kind of bureaucratic and institutional response is fanned and encouraged.
I mean, you call it the culture of reporting upstairs. That's how it's known in Russia, or in the post-Soviet states.
I think the culture of reporting upstairs, yes, it's something that has been, that's an important thing for understanding how post-Soviet states work and how Soviet states work, right? Where none of it was about what actually happened. All of it was about keeping your place or advancing up the party ladder. And in order to do that, you had to give a cheerful report to your superiors. And, you know, in my analysis, for example, the reason the Chernobyl catastrophe, which Americans have now become very familiar with, was covered up, was not so much to hide from the population the danger, but to hide from the from the party heads, to tell them that everything was under control, because all you always had to do was report that everything was in order and you had done an outstanding job. And because there was no media, and because there were no elections, and because there was no freedom of information, information didn't circulate, it could be entirely divorced from reality on the ground. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the culture that Trump has managed to foster in 3.5 years, which is kind of mind-boggling.
Okay. Well, Masha, hang on here for a second, because I want to turn back to Mark before I have to let him go. And speaking about realities on the ground, coming back to the Senate Intelligence Committee report, Mark, I want to talk with you. I want to get your response to how the Senate itself, senators, have been responding to what the report found. So first of all, here is Senator Marco Rubio.
After interviewing over 200 witnesses and reviewing over 1 million pages of documents, we can now say three things without any hesitation. First, we found absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Donald Trump or his campaign colluded with Russia to meddle in our elections. Second, the FBI made some very troubling mistakes, especially by relying on a Steele dossier against the advice of the CIA and without verifying this foreign document or the sources that were used to create it. And third, Russia's still meddling, and now so is China and Iran.
That's Senator Marco Rubio in a video posted on his Twitter account. Here is the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner of Virginia, being very cautious about how he talks about the report. This is what he said in an interview with CNN last week.
You know, I'm not sure it's going to change anybody's mind about what happened in 2016, but when you see the extensive nature of the contacts, and then when you have as recently as 10 days ago, the American intelligence community saying that Russia is back, trying to spread a disinformation campaign about Joe Biden, you know, I think we should all be concerned about that. And what I'm trying to push the intelligence community is, you know, they need to obviously protect sources and methods, but they need to help educate the American public about this disinformation campaign so that we can be better on guard. Americans ought to be deciding this election, not foreigners.
Mark Mazzetti, so what does this mean? Like, is nothing going to happen following this report?
Well, I mean, from those clips you play, I mean, everyone's got their talking points down, certainly, right? You know, it was put out now to raise awareness of what, you know, is coming or is happening right now with regard to the November election. But I do think that going to Senator Rubio's point, you know, maybe there won't be a lot of minds that have been changed on this. People have, you know, decided to believe what they're going to believe. But I will say, and this is where I would disagree with Masha on one point, the reason why I think this report is significant after the Mueller investigation is that the Attorney General, William Barr, has spent more than a year kind of dismantling or trying to dismantle what Mueller did. And I think he's been pretty effective doing that and changing the narrative. And I think that this report sort of reaffirms some of what the conclusions were. And the fact that it was done with Republican support, I think, while it might not change a lot of minds, I think it's meaningful for the future.
Well, Mark Mazzetti, investigative correspondent for The New York Times and a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter on the Trump campaign and Russia. Mark, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for having me.
We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to be talking about the Republican Party's non-platform platform. Or in other words, the fact that this year, for the 2020 presidential convention, the party has opted to not have an official platform, but instead has professed its fealty for President Trump's agenda. So what do you think that means when typically a convention is an opportunity for a party to present its ideas, its bold vision for America? The fact that the GOP has decided not to present such a document, what's your response to that? What do you think the Republican Party stands for now? What do you think it should stand for, especially if you are a Republican? Would love to hear from you on that. Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And leave us a voicemail with your thoughts or questions, and we'll use it on tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about Russian President Vladimir Putin's power plays, both in the 2016 presidential election here and in 2020. Again, in terms of the U.S. election, but also domestically in Russia. And Masha Gessen joins us. Masha's a staff writer for The New Yorker, author of many books, including Surviving Autocracy and The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. And Masha joins us via Skype today. So I want to spend the last portion of the program, Masha, today talking about the poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. We're seeing reports here that the hospital in Germany, in Berlin, where he is being treated now today, says that tests indicate that he was indeed poisoned and that the outcome of the disease that he's currently suffering from remains uncertain. So first of all, can you explain to us specifically who Navalny is, and why he's, in your writing, why he's such a thorn in Vladimir Putin's side?
Well, Alexei Navalny is definitely the most prominent opponent to Vladimir Putin in Russia and has been for quite a long time. He rose to prominence in the aughts as an anti-corruption blogger. He sort of invented this way of calling the Russian government to account by examining open source documents. His first target were just documents about government tenders and income, bureaucrats' income, that sort of thing. It was an amazing approach at that point in Russia because he was actually trying to hold a completely unaccountable government accountable. And over the last decade, his anti-corruption operation has grown into a huge investigative outfit. They have really perfected their investigative techniques. They have also created YouTube channels, other online media, and they have exposed an incredible amount of malfeasance and abuse of power in Russia. And the government has tried to silence Navalny by a thousand cuts. They sentenced him to 5 years in prison in 2013 on trumped-up charges of embezzlement. And thousands of people came out into the streets of Moscow in July 2013 to protest the prison sentence. The government backtracked. They actually, I think, got scared of thousands of people, all of whom were personally willing to risk arrest. Nothing like that had happened in Putin's Russia, where that many people came out for what had not been a sanctioned protest. And so they backtracked and withdrew the prison sentence. And since then, they've tried to place him under house arrest. They've placed him under administrative arrest numerous times for anywhere between 10 and 20 days. One of those times, a year ago, he was also poisoned. He was rushed to the hospital from a detention center where he was being held. And he's persisted through all of this, being very active and incredibly, I would say, inventive. Like, he finds and sees so many ways of drawing attention to things that really can mobilize people in Putin's government. And I think Putin finds that truly terrifying.
Mm. So there's so much to ask you about the inner workings of Putin's government and how he handles opposition leaders. But you write about how the history of opposition figures being poisoned is so long that it's tedious to recite, and that, in fact, tea has been used multiple times before. Why is poisoning such a preferred method of the Russian government?
I think at this point it might be habit. I mean, poisoning was, I think, a preferred method because a lot of the time poisoning results in the kind of illness that's difficult to diagnose. So it's, you know, there's never a smoking gun, literally. And it's a government that doesn't care so much about actual deniability, but it's kind of rhetorical, propagandistic deniability that's important. When Navalny was hospitalized in Omsk a couple of days ago, Russian state media claimed that he wasn't poisoned. It was some sort of gastrointestinal trouble. We now finally have German doctors saying beyond any doubt he was poisoned. But this is rare. A lot of Russian opposition figures were poisoned and never had foreign medics giving a definitive diagnosis. And I think that's why poisoning is so convenient.
Okay, and it's defectors, journalists, activists. The list is quite long that you write for over many years in even in the Soviet era as well. But so getting back to Navalny,
it goes way
though,
back. Yeah, and this German clinic is treating a Russian an activist who is a victim of Russian poisoning for the second time in 2 years. This particular German clinic.
And people will remember the cases that where the poisoning of Russians outside of Russia as well. I'm thinking of, you know, the cases that in Great Britain. So I think the deniability is part of it, but also is the brazenness part of the point as well?
Absolutely. I mean, this is very much the way that Putin wields power. And, you know, it's become fairly familiar to Americans now through the prism of Donald Trump. But it's a kind of bully technique, right? Everybody can see that Navalny was poisoned. We would assume that he was poisoned on behalf of the government or by the government because he is the government's opponent. And yet Putin will continue to say that that he didn't do it. I mean, he is like the kid in the playground who took your lunchbox and is holding it in his hand, and you're saying, give it back to him. He says, I didn't take it. And what he is showing at that point is he is showing his ability to say whatever he wants, whenever he wants to. And he has the power to do that, and no one else has the power to call him on it.
This is sounding familiar, to be quite frank. Right. But so you ask a really important question in your writing about the Navalny case. You ask, why try to assassinate him now? What's the answer to that?
Well, I think there are two possible answers, and I think it would be intellectually dishonest to give just one, right? Because we always have to keep in mind that whatever, you know, Russia, however Russia might loom in the American imagination, it's not a well-functioning, well-organized system. So one answer is always possibly for no reason, just because it happened now, because the opportunity presented itself, because somebody was trying to do an excellent job and get a promotion, right? There may actually be no meaning to the timing. But assuming there is some meaning to the timing, what I think it is that Vladimir Putin is observing what's happening in neighboring Belarus, which is not just a neighboring country. It's actually a country that Russia has a union treaty with, whatever that means. But and what's happened in Belarus is that it is the longest standing dictatorship in Europe. Alexander Lukashenko has been in power for 26 years. And he has total control of the information sphere. He has total control of, he's completely repressed civil society. He has jailed and maimed and forced into exile all of his opponents. And yet he has not been able to prevent hundreds of thousands of Belarusians coming out into the streets. At this point, they have been in the streets for 2 weeks protesting a clearly rigged or clearly falsified election, and there's no sign that they're going back. There's also, unfortunately, no sign that Lukashenko is resigning. But I think Putin finds that terrifying, right? How do you prevent an uprising like that, a truly spontaneous show of just how fed up people are, even though they have no access to electoral mechanisms, they have no access to the media, they have no access to the tools of organizing, and yet they're out in the streets. And the answer is you can't prevent it, right? It's going to happen sooner or later. And so what Putin does is he tries to take out the presumptive leader of that uprising. And of course, that presumptive leader is Alexei Navalny. And Navalny has been able to inspire and, I don't want to say organize, because he, like Belarusians, doesn't have access to the tools of organizing, right? Like meetings or being able to form a political organization. But he has been able to call forward protests, mass protests, consistently over the last few years.
So this is interesting because to exactly that point, he has been able to call forward mass protests. And presuming for a moment that it is indeed Putin that ordered the poisoning of Navalny, is Putin then presuming that his death wouldn't actually precipitate those very same mass protests? I'm just curious. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, you know, competence is actually not it's not a trait or it's not a word that I would use to characterize the Kremlin. And you are probably, if God forbid, Navalny doesn't recover, you will hear that argument from Russian state media. You will hear it from the Kremlin saying, you know, look, we lose more by having him die this way than we stood to gain. But the fact is Russia consistently kills, the Kremlin consistently kills its opponents. Right? Ultimately, Putin seems to believe that a dead opponent is better than a living opponent. And so as, you know, as much as that may be a highly risky strategy, it's certainly a consistent strategy.
Mm. I mean, it's the strategy of pure authoritarianism.
It's the strategy of someone who desperately holds on to power, who at once has total power and believes that he has the claim to total power and is terrified of losing it.
Does it matter at all that the global community has not heard a vociferous condemnation of this from the United States, from President Trump?
I think it matters on two counts. One is, it just demonstrates the extent to which the United States has abdicated its moral and political responsibility in the world. Right? The United States has yet to issue a strong statement on Belarus, and the United States has yet to issue a strong statement on the assassination attempt on Alexei Navalny. And, we used to think, and this was not very long ago, that what the United States said mattered and that it was our country's duty to be a kind of, I know with all the caveats, right? But there was a moral duty to sound the alarm or to pass judgment when things like this happened in the world. So that's an abdication, but also just think about the heartbreak of it. The heartbreak for the people of Belarus and the heartbreak for Alexei Navalny's friends and family. He has been this lone warrior going up against the Kremlin, which has attacked him in every way imaginable, and now has finally made an attempt on his life. And he has been basically alone, right? I mean, obviously, he has a lot of supporters in Russia. Otherwise, he wouldn't scare Putin so much. But he is alone and exposed most of the time. And it used to be that there would at least be other countries, such as the United States, that would say, we, to the extent that we can, we've got your back. We will, we'll try to hold Putin's feet to the fire if something happens to you. And that's, that's not a hugely expensive or labor-intensive political undertaking. It's just the right one. And even that is gone.
Mm. Masha, we have just a minute left to go. And every time I read your writing, a question pops up over and over again in my mind. You fled Russia. Came to the United States. I do wonder what you think about the fact that you find yourself now writing about how many echoes you see of what you fled being played out around you here in the U.S.
This was not how I was planning to spending this decade of my life. It's a very odd thing. And, as I said earlier in the show, I don't know that that Russia necessarily provides the best mirror for the United States. It happens to be the autocracy I spent so many years studying, and I think it gives me some optics that are incredibly useful for watching what happens here now.
Well, I want to continue watching that through your lens. I'd love to have you back on the show sometime. So Masha Gessen, staff writer at The New Yorker, author of many books, including Surviving Autocracy and The Future is History. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.